University of Cambridge Graduate Diploma in Economics. Dr. Mark Hayes on Monetary Macroeconomics. Lecture 1, Introduction to the Monetary Approach to Business Cycles. Over the last century, the theory of business cycles has been hotly contested between what we might call the classicals and the Keynesians. The Keynesians claimed to have superseded the classicals, and for 40 years they dominated the field. 35 years ago I sat where you sat and listened to Joan Robinson denounce classical economics as metaphysics. After the economic turmoil of the 1970s, the pendulum swung back, and over the last 30 years there has developed an uneasy consensus in which Keynesian insights have been reduced to a special case of the classical model, quite the opposite of what Keynes claimed in his 1936 book, The General Theory. Some years ago, Professor Gregory Mankiw wrote, I quote, "Dubious Keynesian proposition number one. Learning how the economy works is best achieved by a careful reading of Keynes's general theory. Since Keynesian economics is derived by definition from the work of John Maynard Keynes, one might suppose that reading Keynes is an important part of Keynesian theorizing. In fact, quite the opposite is the case." He goes on to say very humbly, "If new Keynesian economics is not a true representation of Keynes's views, then so much the worse for Keynes." In fairness, he has recanted since 2008, but his book, which you are reading, has not substantially changed. And in these lectures, I will set out the current consensus position, broadly as set out in Mankiw's book. You will detect a note of scepticism in that I will point out the weaknesses as well as the strengths of the new consensus. However, this is not the place for me to present an alternative. I'll be shot by the faculty board. But if you are interested in that, you can listen to 8 hours of my podcast lectures and read my book on the general theory. I will place the link on the website under Other, and you can download the whole book if you wish. There's also an excellent introduction to the general theory at a more basic level than my book by Brendan Sheehan. I'll also send you a link by email to an unfinished draft of a text, Macroeconomics Restated, which is intended as an antidote to Mankiw's text, but is an unfinished draft. You may also wish to read another Cambridge economist, unreconstructed, Jim Trevithick's book, Involuntary Unemployment, which is slightly dated, but more accessible and gives a flavour of the alternative. If you want to go the whole distance, read Joan Robinson and John Eatwell's 1974 Introduction to Modern Economics. You'll find all these references on the reading list, which I hope you've got. John Eatwell is still very much around as President of Queen's, as you probably know, and I can recommend his 2010 book with Murray Milgate, also of Queen's, The Fall and Rise of Keynesian Economics. A good alternative to Mankiw within the consensus is Wendy Carlin and David Soskis's Macroeconomics, Imperfections, Institutions and Policies. It's very well written, but you may find it a bit of a jump if you've got no previous economics training. It uses a slightly different, more modern model to the one in Mankiw, but the main intuitions are not essentially different from what I shall present in these lectures. You have, I hope, enjoyed the lectures on intertemporal macroeconomics by Dr. Pontus Rendahl. These are an exposition of the classical model. So how does Keynesian monetary macro
Any more? How does Keynesian monetary macro differ from classical intertemporal macro? It's vital to be clear on the differences, or you will become horribly confused. The key difference is, of course, what? Money. Although there have been various attempts to incorporate money into the classical model, the problem is that money is inessential to the model, as Frank Hahn, another distinguished Cambridge figure, once put it. And by money, I do not mean a banking or financial sector, such as Dr. Gerhardt's will address in her Part 2A lectures on monetary economics, which you may go to, though they're optional, I think, for you. The classical model can, as you will have learned, incorporate claims on future output, that is, a form of finance. Monetary macro is distinguished from intertemporal macro by giving a central role to the money prices and aggregate values of the demand for goods and services and of their aggregate supply. And furthermore, in monetary macro, the quantity of money determines the rate of interest and not directly the general level of money prices. And in the classical model, by contrast, money is neutral, and the quantity of money determines the general price level, but not the rate of interest. It's the other way around. The classical system is driven by the relative prices of goods and services, not by the money or nominal prices. In particular, it is demand and supply in the labour market that determine the natural rates of output, employment, and unemployment. And the key relative price is the real wage, i.e. the price of labour services in terms of consumption goods. It is the return on physical capital which determines the real interest rate. So money per se does not affect real activity in the classical model. And there are some key points you need to grasp firmly if you're to keep your bearings when moving between the two models, especially when you read Mankiw. In the classical model, the level of income, which is the same as the value of output, okay, is determined primarily by the supply side in the labour market, as I've said. The real wage determines the levels of employment and output. The aggregate demand for this output accommodates the aggregate supply and never falls short. And this is because the real interest rate, equal, as I said, to the rate of profit on new physical capital, clears the loanable funds market for the supply and demand of saving for investment. In other words, aggregate consumption and investment are brought into balance by the real interest rate. But aggregate demand is always in balance with aggregate supply, as determined in the labour market. So that's the classical model. In the Keynesian model, the level of income is determined primarily by the demand side in the goods and money markets. The level of employment determines the real wage, the opposite of the classical direction of causation. The nominal interest rate on money loans clears the market for the supply and demand for money. The interest rate determines aggregate demand, and this can be less than aggregate supply. So that's the key difference. In the classical model, the interest rate is measured in real terms and matches saving with investment. In the Keynesian model, the interest rate is nominal, meaning it is measured at face value in money terms. It matches the demand to hold wealth in the form of money deposits with the supply of money created by the banking system. These two different stories are like oil and water, and they don't mix. It does not help that we often casually refer to a stock of money in a deposit account as savings, which is quite different from saving, which is the part of income, a flow, that you do not consume. Nor does it help that Mankiw fudges the issue by bringing the quantity theory of money and the market for loanable funds into his discussion of the Keynesian model. We'll talk about that later, and I'm not going to do that. I usually write the symbol R to represent the real interest rate, which belongs to the classical model, and the symbol little I to represent the nominal interest rate in the Keynesian model. The equivalent of the real interest rate in the Keynesian model is the nominal interest rate less the expected rate of inflation. But in the Keynesian world, the real rate does not exist as such. It's the resultant of those two. So how are these two models, the classical and the Keynesian, to be reconciled? The consensus is that the Keynesian model holds in the short run, but collapses back into the classical model in the long run. The reason for this is the view that the Keynesian model depends on sticky or fixed prices, which prevent markets clearing. As prices respond to competitive forces and become flexible, all markets clear. Money becomes neutral, and we return to the classical model. This is a very strong assumption indeed, and quite funny for anyone who's actually read the general theory. One reason, perhaps, for Mankiw trying to dissuade students from doing so. Keynes's main purpose was to show that competition alone, meaning full price and wage flexibility, was not sufficient to deliver full employment. It was his main opponent here in Cambridge, Professor A.C. Pigou, who suggested in his 1943 article on the classical stationary state that if the price level fell far enough, there would always be enough aggregate demand to ensure full employment. Yet Pigou himself admitted that this was merely theoretical as a proposition and of no real policy relevance. Vasily Leontiev quipped that if prices fell low enough, you could buy the whole national output of the United States for a dime. Yet it was another American economist, Irving Fisher, who resisted calls for price deflation because it would lead, and did lead, during the Great Depression, to widespread bankruptcies and bank failures and huge damage to the supply side. As prices fall, the real value of debts, which are fixed in terms of money, increases, and people and banks go bust. The consensus model is generally described as New Keynesian, but as another great American economist, James Tobin, put it, if he had a copyright on the use of the word Keynesian, he would sue. A better description would be New Pigouvian, but it doesn't have quite the same ring, does it? We now seem to be using the term new consensus, which at least is more accurate. Nevertheless, it is quite true that Keynes's early followers normally assumed fixed prices in their textbook expositions. They did this to bypass Keynes's own complex exposition of aggregate supply and demand, the principle of effective demand, which was his replacement for the classical concept of general equilibrium. And in the first part of his discussion, Mankiw does exactly the same. He assumes fixed prices. The advantage of assuming fixed prices is that we can assume that a change in aggregate demand, measured in money, is a change in demand measured in real terms. That's not strictly correct, and it's certainly not how Keynes proceeded. But it makes for a simple story, and it's stuck. Since the classical model assumes flexible prices, it becomes easy to fix upon this assumption in the early exposition as the key difference between the two models. The further step is to assume that prices are sticky in the short run, but eventually adjust Therefore, it is claimed, the monetary model works for the short run, but the intertemporal model is what matters for long-run policy. The consensus has another advantage, but also a potential source of confusion, in that we can draw aggregate supply and demand diagrams in both models, which look very similar. In the intertemporal lectures, you will have seen diagrams like this, with Y for real output on one axis and R for real interest on the other. Aggregate supply is a matter of labour supply, which is a function of the interest rate through the intertemporal substitution of consumption now for consumption later. You've heard all this, you've been doing it this morning. Aggregate demand is also a function of the interest rate. The intersection of the curves is the equilibrium solution for interest rate and output. We then shift curves to study the effects on the equilibrium position of temporary and permanent productivity shocks and changes in government spending and taxation. Note that there's no room for money or monetary policy in this diagram. This is the real interest rate and not the nominal interest rate. You will recall you've only discussed fiscal policy in the intertemporal lectures. We can use the diagram to explain, in a simple way, the business cycle in terms of productivity and preference shocks to the equilibrium, a real business cycle theory. So that's the intertemporal diagram. In these lectures, we will be using and deriving a diagram like this one. Again, with Y for real output on one axis, but this time with P for the general money price level on the other. In fact, we will spend most of the lectures building up the model behind this diagram. First, the aggregate demand curve, and then the aggregate supply curves. That's the vertical long-run LRAS and a sloping short-run curve, SRAS. We will be able to use this diagram to explore fiscal and monetary policies, as well as both supply and demand shocks. In fact, to begin with, we'll use this slightly different version with a horizontal SRAS curve, which is the one in Mankiw. This corresponds to the early Keynesian simplification of assuming fixed prices. I'm going fast because we're short of time. I hope that's okay. Let's just discuss what this diagram means one piece at a time. We begin with the AD curve. It's downward sloping, which is what you'd expect demand curves to do. The price level falls and there is more demand for total output, like pizza, right? No, that's wrong. P is the general or average price level, the cost of living, if you like, as measured by CPI. Supply and demand curves in microeconomics plot quantities against relative prices. The relative prices in intertemporal macro are the real wage and the real interest rate. P, here, is not a relative price at all. So how does P affect aggregate demand? We'll be discussing that. And for the moment, you'll have to take it on trust that a fall in the price level increases aggregate demand. Yet, of course, P is not the only influence on aggregate demand. Far from it. We simply need this relationship between P and Y in order to link up the Keynesian and classical models and to build the consensus story. I think you're now already familiar with the idea that we use two-dimensional diagrams to represent complex, multidimensional equilibrium models. The diagram shows the relationship between two of the endogenous variables, all other things being equal, or ceteris paribus, as Alfred Marshall used to say when we all knew Latin. The other variables, particularly the exogenous variables that the model does not explain, cannot be seen directly in the diagram. But we show the effect of changes in them by shifting the curves. In this case, an increase in spending plans, for example, because people have more confidence in the future, is represented by a shift in the curve to the right. Does it? It can, of course, shift to the left as well, if the future looks gloomy and people draw their horns in. Now, one curve is not a model. We need at least one other to have an intersection and therefore an equilibrium solution. What we're doing is solving a set of simultaneous equations graphically using a diagram in the time-honoured fashion first drawn by Alfred Marshall in his Principles of Economics, which was the first textbook in the economics tripos when we began 110 years ago in 1903. The other curve we need is the SRAS curve. Short run, you will recall, because the new consensus holds that the assumption of fixed prices corresponds to the short run, before prices have had time to adjust. And this is a very boring curve, a horizontal line. What it tells us is that the aggregate amount that employers wish to supply in response to demand from customers is independent of the general price level. Of course, the amount an individual firm will supply may well be affected by the price of its own particular goods or services. Supply curves in microeconomics usually slope upwards, an increase in price calling forth more offers of supply. But once again, we're here discussing the general price level, P. Now we can bring the two curves together, I think. Yep. Aggregate demand plots the amount people plan to spend given the price level P. SRAS plots the amount firms are willing to supply at a set of arbitrarily fixed money prices which average out at P bar. Basically, firms advertise their selling prices and then supply whatever people order. That's not so unrealistic, is it? With aggregate demand represented by AD1, the intersection corresponds to a level of income and output Y1. And we can now see quite easily what happens if demand increases. The AD curve shifts to AD2 and output rises to Y2. The level of aggregate demand determines the level of employment. Well, output and then employment. At the very simplest level, we've explained fluctuations in income and output, the business cycle, in terms of demand. Very simple level. Now, we could stop there for a lecture or two, because I've yet to explain why the AD curve slopes downward, and in particular, why we draw it in any particular place. However, in order to give you a flavour of the overall direction and point of these lectures, we need to go one step further and develop the consensus bridge between the Keynesian and classical models. And it's actually quite an elegant story. And this is where the vertical LRAS long-run aggregate supply curve enters the picture. Supply curves are usually sloping. Yeah? This one is vertical because the level of output Y bar is independent of the general price level. It's determined by the real side of the economy. So this one's, again, not to be confused with a micro supply curve or the ones in intertemporal macro where the real interest rate is on the vertical axis. Do always look at what's on the axes. The vertical supply curve is telling us that in the long run, the level of output Y bar is determined by the classical model. The argument goes that in the long run, prices are flexible, all markets clear, we're back to exchanging real goods and services for real goods and services, money's just a go-between and drops out. Money's neutral. Money prices do not affect real activity. So this natural rate of output, Y bar, corresponds to the level of output in the intertemporal macro model. Okay? Y bar is independent of the general price level, P is therefore vertical. Any price level will do. Mankiw puts it slightly differently in his text, where he writes down a production function in terms of exogenous K and L so that Y bar is fixed. You've learned from Dr. Rendahl that K and L are themselves functions of the real interest rate and wage rates. There is therefore room for Y bar to fluctuate, and indeed that is what we mean by a real business cycle. The link between the short run and the long run is that prices rise in the long run if Y is greater than Y bar, and they fall if Y is less than Y bar. Now this makes sense if we assume that Y bar is the natural rate of output. Natural suggests stable, relaxed, harmonious. If demand pushes output above its natural rate, there is strain on resources and relative scarcity, so that competition drives up prices. Conversely, output below the natural rate means relative excess supply. We can illustrate the effect of demand pushing output away from its natural rate using the ADAS diagram. In this example, demand increases, and since prices are fixed in the short run, output rises from its long-run equilibrium level Y bar to Y2, corresponding to the model's new short-run equilibrium B. With Y2 greater than Y bar, prices rise. Isn't that good? And this moves us along the new AD curve towards the new long-run equilibrium, point C. What this diagram, I'm sorry, I've not had time, as you know, there's been a slight delay in these lectures. I've not had time to redo these slides. So what's missing from these slides is that the SRAS line is moving up as the price level rises. Okay, so imagine that shifting up. You're always on the AD curve, you're always on the short-run AS curve, but point B moves to C. So the result is that we converge back to the long-run equilibrium and output's back at Y bar, but the price level has risen from P bar to P2. Yep. Now, the key reason that output departs from equilibrium in the consensus model is a random disturbance or shock, either to demand or supply. Note the overriding commitment in this statement to the concept of long-run full employment equilibrium. We can't have long-run unemployment or stagnation of output, provided that prices are flexible. Given free competition, the economy always bounces back from a disturbance, like a mechanical system. Shocks can be temporary or permanent, but a permanent shock does not mean that the economy is held out of equilibrium permanently. It just means that the economy finds a new equilibrium. A new level of output becomes natural. Examples of demand shocks are a banking crisis, a major new discovery, or the outbreak of war. These affect both consumption and investment, or net exports, these three key elements of private spending on the national output. A negative demand shock is represented in the diagram simply by a shift of the AD curve to the left this time. We'll do the same exercise. With prices fixed, the fall in demand at the initial price level means a fall in output. So we go down to Y2. Once again, the economy is expected to return to the long-run equilibrium once the price level has had time to adjust, by falling in this case. The SRAS line falls, it's not there, but you can see, imagine it falling, and moves the short-run equilibrium of B back towards long-run equilibrium at C with a lower price level but the same natural rate of output, Y bar. Whereas a demand shock affects the AD curve, a supply shock affects short-run and or long-run supply conditions. In other words, it affects the prices that firms need to charge to cover their costs and achieve their target rate of profit. Supply shocks affect productivity, the availability of raw material supplies, or technology. These can either be temporary or permanent. And thinking back to the intertemporal model, this may affect the natural rate of output through a reduction in labour supply in response to the fall in income. So you can get the long-run natural rate of output is not immutable. And of course, shocks can be positive as well as negative. Mankiw gives us an example of a negative supply shock, the 1970s oil crisis, which affected the availability of raw material supplies. The formation of a cartel allowed OPEC to restrict the supply of oil, which led to a massive increase in the price. And the standard narrative suggests this was a random shock caused by Arab-Israeli politics, but this omits a vital economic factor that Nixon broke the US commitment to convert dollars to gold at a fixed parity in 1971, thereby ending the Bretton Woods system. Commodity prices shot up, but oil prices were still fixed in US dollars. OPEC was not entirely politically motivated. Nevertheless, in terms of our model, we shift up the SRAS curve. So a different curve shift, forcing the economy up the AD curve to a lower level of output, a combination of price rises and unemployment that came to be known as stagflation. Once again, the idea is that with output below Y-bar, prices will fall, the SRAS line will move down, and ceteris paribus, we will end up back at B in the long run. And Mankiw gives us some stylized data for the US economy. Over time, which shows the effect of the spike in oil prices there on the price level there, and a sharp rise in unemployment corresponding to output being below the natural rate, followed by a gradual decline in inflation and unemployment. Note that the long run here is very long. 4 years after the spike, unemployment is still 2 percentage points above the 5% where it started. Excuse me. Now these charts, again from the book, illustrate clearly the idea of random shocks to output, consumption and investment. These are annual growth rates rather than levels, but we can see the average rate of growth over the period. The pink bars are the periods of recession. And there's the consumption growth rate, tracking the GDP income growth rate quite closely. Now, these charts show what looks like random fluctuations around a trend, which is what you would expect from a stochastic model in which the economy is shocked around a long-run equilibrium position which holds pretty steady. However, this is a somewhat selective use of data. This is the same chart for investment, and there's unemployment. But if we look at unemployment over a longer period, 1881 to 2000, you will note that the period from 1945 to 1970, the period immediately before the Mankiw charts, shows much tighter fluctuation around a much lower average of about 2%. This was the period of the Bretton Woods system, which broke down in 1971, as I said. This was a purely financial event. And there's no reason to believe the real economy had suddenly and fundamentally changed in real terms. The system broke before the oil crisis. If we look at, if you can see it, if we look at the period 1919 to 39, I can't see the pointer, but it's there anyway. There's clearly a plateau of 10% below which unemployment never fell. And the fluctuations are not even. In the jargon of econometrics, the data is heteroskedastic. The variance, the fluctuations itself varies. And indeed, there's no reason to believe that this represents a stochastic random process at all. If we come up to date and consider the level of UK GDP over the last few years, we get a similar picture of a major break in the trend associated with the 2008 financial crisis. These are levels, okay? If we look at growth rates, again, we have a very unstochastic series. Now, it may be argued that these figures are distorted by government policy, notably the policy of fiscal austerity since 2010, and indeed there is truth in that. But so too were the figures during the Bretton Woods era. Only if we look back to the period, 1881 to 1914, do we get the impression of a period similar to 1970 to 2008. And indeed, it's no accident. But these are the periods when government policy, fiscal policy in particular, were either non-existent or considered ineffective, partly as the result of the work of my dear classical colleagues. And that remark I will explain in later lectures. There is another way of interpreting Y-bar in the ADAS diagram. The consensus is that, as I've said, it represents the natural rate of output of the real economy as described by intertemporal macroeconomics. However, there is a logical jump here, which it's very important to understand. Let's consider this slide again. The underpinning of the model and the definition of Y-bar is that prices rise if Y is greater than Y-bar and fall if Y is less than Y-bar. In a more sophisticated model than this, we can have inflation rather than the price level, rising or falling as y exceeds or falls short of y bar. Y bar is simply the level of output at which there is no tendency for the price level or the rate of inflation to change. The consensus model asserts, and it is no more than an assertion, that the reason the price level changes is that there is an excess demand or supply for the economy's natural rate of output. Prices rise if the economy overheats, if the gap between actual and natural output is positive, fall if there's a negative output gap. There are various reasons why prices might rise, and we will discuss those when we consider aggregate supply in a later lecture. The most obvious one is that wages increase when there's excess demand for labour and fall when there's excess supply. But this, of course, assumes that at Y bar we have full employment in the sense of intertemporal macro. To the natural rate of output, there corresponds a natural rate of unemployment, which simply reflects normal change in the economy with people coming into and out of the labour market and taking a little time to find suitable work. But what the logic of the ADAS model actually depends on is not the natural rate, but something with the horrible acronym NERU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. Let's call it U-bar. That is what we have defined Y-bar to be. If Y is above Y-bar and U is below U-bar, price rises, and vice versa. That's the definition of the NERU. However, it does not follow that Y bar is the natural rate of output corresponding to classical full employment. All we're saying is that there is a certain level of output and unemployment at which prices or inflation are stable. It does not follow that everyone, whether in work or looking for it, is making a voluntary choice between labour and leisure, as we're told in the Robinson Crusoe stories. There are alternative explanations of Y-bar. They are much more complicated and messy and involve sociology and politics. In particular, the main driver of money wage growth historically appears to be the lack of a social consensus on wage differentials. As employment rises and unemployment falls, bottlenecks arise for particular types of worker, and this pushes up their money wages. People have strong ideas of fairness, and this may lead to pay claims to keep pace. If inflation starts to rise, perhaps triggered by a supply shock, as in the 1970s, this can turn into a vicious spiral of competing claims, increasing inflation further. But there's nothing natural about this, engraved in technology and preferences. This chart shows the course of UK inflation and unemployment over the 20th century. Throughout the Bretton Woods period, both unemployment and inflation were low and stable. Inflation started to rise at the end of the 1960s. Following the devaluation of sterling in 1967, which you could think of as a supply shock. Furthermore, when we try to measure Y-bar and U-bar, we find they jump around. Much econometrics is expended trying to pin down the natural rate, but it's proving very elusive, to put it mildly. We then start to hear explanations that the natural rate has changed for one reason or another, usually something to do with the laziness or militancy of workers. However, at a theoretical level, and that's what we're talking about here, the concept is substantially weakened once we admit that we do not really know what Y-bar is. And it's certainly not a physical constant like the force of gravity. From a sociological perspective, this is not at all surprising. The consensus therefore invests a lot in this ADAS model as the bridge between the Keynesian and the classical models, conventionally described as the short run and the long run models. There is, of course, some value in recognizing that prices can rise when employment is high and unemployment is low. However, it's equally legitimate to stick with the short run and develop an alternative theory of wages and prices, which does not rely on the concept of a long-run natural equilibrium rate of output and employment, though I'm not going to do that in these lectures. But as Keynes famously put it, in the long run, we're all dead. Either way, in the next lecture, I will start to explain how the AD curve is constructed using the building blocks of the Keynesian cross and Hicks's ISLM model. So to summarise and wrap up, and we've just about done it in time. In the monetary macro model, the ADAS model plots Y against P rather than Y against R, as in the intertemporal model. The aggregate demand curve, AD curve, slopes downward for reasons that we are not yet ready to examine. The short-run aggregate supply curve, the SRAS, is horizontal because of the assumption of fixed prices. The long-run aggregate supply curve, the LRAS, is vertical because this comes from the classical model, and in the classical model, the general level of prices is irrelevant. Money is neutral. Only relative prices matter. In this model, this ADAS model, the economy moves from its short-run sticky fixed price equilibrium to a long-run equilibrium through changes in the general price level. But, of course, supply and demand shocks can push the economy temporarily out of its long-run equilibrium. And indeed, of course, shocks can permanently affect the long-run equilibrium. But the point is, you always get back to it, whatever it is. And the consensus holds that Y-bar is the natural rate of output from the intertemporal model, which you've been learning in the first set of lectures. But as I think you probably now realise, this is contested.